If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage. Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the USS Enterprise.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to the Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. A Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed about having a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
You are. And I am Ben Harrison.
We're doing that wrestling move where I get into the ring and you point at me, and then you get into the ring and I point at you. Maybe a little bit of pyro.
Yeah.
What kind of wrestler would you be if you were a wrestler? Would you be like spikes and face paint, or would you just be like a dad-looking guy in a leotard?
A lot of those guys are wearing like jean shorts these days. I don't think I would be that type of wrestler. I know that the crowd would not like me.
if our live shows tell us anything,
yeah,
I think we could both agree on that. We'd be heels.
Even if I was positioned as a face, I think that they would prefer the heel to win.
God, when was the last time you wore or owned jean shorts? It has been a long time for me.
I think it was middle school was probably the last time.
Wow. Yeah, very unkind. Sartorially unkind are the jean shorts.
I don't understand the point, you know?
If you want to get cool, you don't want to wear denim anyway.
Oh, man, that little thing old breezy, man.
It's like a tank top made out of like merino wool or something, you know? It's like...
it's like a chainmail tank top. Made of wool and not chains.
Yeah, it's really working at cross purposes and not protecting you from pipes.
Let off some steam, Bennett.
Are you staying cool in the summer heat, Ben?
I'm trying to. I realized that I used to live, when I lived in Brooklyn, our place had air conditioning that was like, there was a unit in a couple of the rooms. So if we were like, if it was nighttime and way too hot, we could turn on the air conditioner in our bedroom and get a nice cool bedroom and not have to pay to cool the entire house off. And my place in LA, like you can, there are louvers on all the, in all the rooms to shut off the air. But I think the only temperature gauge is in the actual thermostat. So, like, we've had situations where I want to, like, keep our bedroom cold. So I'll close all the louvers all throughout the house and set it to, like, you know, 74 degrees or something. And I know everybody in Canada and Europe is like, what? But that's our dumb system of weights and measures here. Set it to 74 degrees, which should be a nice sleeping temperature. And it gets like insanely frosty in there because the thermostat never detects it. It thinks that like no matter what it does, it's still 80 degrees or whatever. So
you got a couple of closed systems not connected to the main system.
Yeah. I think I need to get one of those smart ones that has sensors around the house, but I'm a renter, you know, I don't want to spend $300 on a thermostat that then going to have to rip out of the wall.
Yeah, now you're just soliciting sponsors. That's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Just nakedly soliciting smart thermostats right now.
Nothing we want less than sponsors for the show, Adam. Am I right?
One cooling technology that I've been fucking around with lately is the Otterpop. And Otterpop recently changed their recipe, Ben. They are a not artificial color, not artificial flavor.
Wow.
Brand of thing. And so they all look the same, which is why they have a white wrapper and not a clear wrapper anymore.
Interesting. I don't know exactly where the Otterpop distribution area is, but I know that they are not a thing on the west, on the East Coast.
Oh, really? It's like a Hellman's mayonnaise situation?
Yeah, like they have this thing, but the Otterpop brand is unknown to many parts of the world. It's not quite sherbet, but it's like a frozen, it's like popsicle stuff in a plastic tube that you like rip the top off of, and then you can kind of like push the popsicle material out of the tube bit by bit as you eat.
Right. And they're sold thawed. Crucially, this is what you know. When you buy them, they're squishy and liquid.
It's a delayed gratification item.
Yeah. 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 My review of the new Otter Pops is a little bit mixed, though, because something about the consistency is different than the way it used to be. Like the old Otter Pop was a little more icy than this, and I feel like modern Otter Pop is very shaley and flaky.
Oh,
it's isn't like that weird?
Is it like a granita?
Yeah, it's more like that. Not bad. Still what you need to get you through a hot day. But I think that's been sort of a thing that I haven't had since I was a kid, and now I'm starting to eat them again. Probably wow. Terrible for me.
Look at that. You can order 100 Otter Pops for $8 off of a major internet retailer.
Yeah,
why were my parents so stingy with these? The price can't have gone down since I was a kid.
Ben, you can get like 500 at Popular Membership Warehouse Club for like $15.
Wow. I need to have like a pool party at my parents-in-law's place with Otter Pops.
Can I come to that pool party? I love a pool party at your parents-in-law's place.
That would be great.
All right, let's make it happen.
Let's do it.
One thing we have to make happen this episode, Ben, is our discussion. The show has been given to us in a way that we must complete. There's a word for that. I'm trying to think of it. Oh, yeah, it's also the name of the episode. It's season 5, episode 5, The Assignment.
Yeah, that is the name of the episode, isn't it?
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
Ben, like morning in America, it is also morning at Quark's.
Yeah.
Crack of dawn. Is Quark's a 24-hour establishment? It doesn't seem that way. It closes all the time.
I wondered about this because we know that Rom works the night shift.
Yeah.
He's here for breakfast, as is Morn. So does Morn work the night shift? Or does Morn just like, is he like a classic alcoholic who parties all night and sleeps all day?
Well,
because Morton seems to be there all the time.
The overnight shift is going to be a midnight to 8 o'clock situation. So if Rom is getting off at around 8, that's not a super early time for a diner or restaurant to open.
No.
So I guess you could argue that he's open regular hours and then he closes at bar close.
But don't a lot of people that work the night shift have like breakfast type food before they head to work?
I mean, I have on occasion worked that shift for up to a month at a time, and it didn't change my diet in any way. It probably should have.
Yeah, what the hell?
I just tried to live a normal life.
Yeah.
And that is not a normal life.
Yeah, no.
Swing doesn't sound so bad. I think I could do a 3 to midnight situation, 2 to midnight.
Yeah. Oh, is that what time it is? Is it the afternoon?
Yeah,
this does kind of have the feel of a bar that's like in between the lunch rush and happy hour.
Yeah. Yeah, like first shift is commonly like 6 to 2-ish. Swing is after that to midnight. And then night shift is midnight to morning. But on the Jellicoe proposition, those shifts are all going to get fucked up.
Oh, like, man.
If you're going to a 4-shift rotation, I don't know what that does.
They did go to a 4-shift rotation.
Does that mean everyone's working between 5 and 6 hours?
Yeah. That doesn't sound bad.
No. No, why isn't Riker into that?
What the hell, Riker?
I thought he'd be a chill boss, but it turns out he's not.
Just doesn't want to deal with all the scheduling.
Yeah. Rom's doing that thing that, people in new jobs like to do sometimes. They want to fit in.
Yeah.
And for Rom, fitting in means eating the eats of the people that he works with. And so he wants to experience this at the counter. I like going to a diner and sitting at the counter, and that's what Rom is doing. He wants to be served the O'Brien breakfast by his brother.
What kind of breakfast is that?
Yeah.
The O'Brien breakfast sounds pretty fucking heavy.
I'm surprised they didn't just go with a full Irish.
Yeah. I don't think Irish people even eat the full Irish. I think that's just for tourists. Though you've been there and you would know. What's the read on that?
I mean, I liked the full Irish for sure.
But you wouldn't do that even twice a week, would you?
No. It's a special occasion breakfast, but
yeah.
I used to have a friend in Liverpool, and when I was doing my study abroad in Ireland, I went and visited him, and he made breakfast one morning when I was staying with him, and he just put a full English together. Like,
wow.
Like, he just had all the stuff around, and I was like, you didn't have to do this special for me. And he's like, this is something we do most days.
I could really get with beans as a part of a healthy breakfast. I really could.
I like beans at breakfast.
Never have them, though.
Yeah.
You know, we should have done that in Vegas. That seems like a place where you can get beans for breakfast.
You can get anything at any time of day in Vegas.
You can't get a hoof before 10 a.m., I'll tell you that much.
That's true. But if you already have the hoof, you could probably get filled up with something somewhere.
O'Brien should be fucking fat if he eats eggs, bacon, corned beef hash every morning, right?
Well, maybe like, he has like Syntha bacon and he can mentally cancel the calories.
I wonder if in the same way that your shit's beamed out of you, you can also beam out a food that has made you feel too full. Feeling too full, I think, is one of the worst feelings. It's hangover adjacent for me. I hate it
so
much.
I've rarely experienced it.
I think
always a bit peckish.
I think you and I both know I'm running on some weird guts. And I think my problem is I just get uncomfortably bloated and gassy.
Have you ever had a mechanic just like take a look down there and make sure everything's like connected correctly?
I've been scoped in both ends, Ben, by a professional. And yeah, they both say the same thing. Inconclusive.
It's got to be really reassuring.
They say the same thing. Inconclusive, but fun. Quark in this scene is job shaming Rom in a way that I do not like.
No, it's a bit weird. It seems almost like it was written by somebody that didn't know that Rom made this like elective choice recently.
Right. Yeah,
because Quark is saying like why do you do that? Why don't you come work with me and we could look at naked babes all day? And that's just like. Quark knows what Rom did, you know?
Yeah. It's one thing to have someone tell you that they're not enjoying their job and then suggest alternatives, but Rom is super into it and happy, and Quark is still twisting his arm about this.
Yeah. Speaking of arm twisting, the Chief and Dr. Bashir, I guess, were left jointly in charge of keeping Keiko's bonsai tree collection alive.
Can't understand it. I followed Keiko's instructions to the letter.
And all of the trees have died, and little Molly comes in, catches them with these dead trees, and starts really twisting the knife.
Mommy's gonna be mad.
O'Brien's like, I just don't understand why the ammonia content of the soil is so high. It's as if someone's been watering them with pure urine.
And Bashir's like, who would do a thing like that? What a terrible waste.
Yeah, this is a fun scene. It's a fun scene because in my mind, I was questioning, like, where the fuck is Kira? Why would you ever give these dopes this job? Kira is the one who should be watering the plants. She knows how to care for things.
Yeah, but she's on Bajor with Shakar.
Yeah.
She's not even in the episode, is she?
In real life, this is the first episode in Deep Space Nine without Nana Visitor.
Whoa.
That's it. The first one.
That is amazing.
Didn't think it was possible.
This is all a prelude to Keiko returning to the station. She's been on Bajor for a little while.
When you say something on Bajor and it could be taken the wrong way, is that known as pejorative?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to clear that up. Moving on.
The chief goes down to the airlock to pick up Keiko. And she accepts the death of her trees with relative chillness.
Forget it, Miles. They're just plants.
Surprising amount of chillness. An almost un-Keiko-like amount of chillness.
Right away, you're suspicious.
This is fucking spectacular.
She is wolfing down these chocolate bonbons, though.
Yeah.
The chief,
yeah, like, take it easy on those bonbons, Keiko.
The chief is very gallantly, by the way, putting this 100% on the doctor's shoulders.
Yeah. But I think Bashir would agree to this, too. Like, he's okay being a human shield for this domestic dispute. Or one that he believes is coming.
Have you ever, like, majorly fucked up something of your wife's? Or vice versa? Has she ever...
Besides her life?
I mean, like a beloved or sentimental object.
I mean, I lost my wedding band the day after we got married.
Oh, yeah.
That comes to mind. I didn't lose it. It was ripped from my finger by the ocean.
The sea was angry that day, my friends.
So you have that story, and another friend of mine has the exact same story, which is getting in the ocean on honeymoon and losing his wedding band.
Yeah.
And so I always take mine off if I'm going to be getting in a body of water. My wife takes great umbrage with that.
Well, she's wrong. She's not wrong very often, Ben, but she's wrong in this case, and I'm the perfect reason why.
I think that there's something very interesting that happens in a relationship when you've, like, messed somebody's shit up.
Yeah.
Like, we tried to have a cookout at my house, which doesn't make any sense because we have no yard. We have about 30 square feet of non-street space in front of our house. And my wife suggested that we push my grill down to the front of the house and do a bit of grilling down there.
Like, but on the sidewalk by the bus stop?
No, like there's a little front yard.
Yeah.
But it's like there's not much of it. There's not enough of it that you could have like it was so awkward because we like brought some chairs out, but you could only get them along one side because if you put them on the other, there wouldn't be anywhere to walk. So it was just a bunch of people sitting in a row. It sucked, but she also wanted to get the grill down there, and we tried to move it, but it weighs like hundreds of pounds because it's made out of ceramic, and
right.
Instead of moving down there, it just fell over and broke part of it.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Oh, and no.
It's a replaceable part. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But also, I have noticed that the part has not been replaced.
Uh-huh.
So, I'm just saying, I know what O'Brien is projecting onto Keiko here. I guess.
Wow. Yeah.
I know how, like, if this was really Keiko, I know how she would feel.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fair. And suspicious behavior from jump from her.
Yeah. She starts saying, "I'm not Keiko," and immediately O'Brien starts interpreting this as kind of a sexy game she might be playing.
No problems.
Yeah, definitely Miles pivots into bedroom game mode.
Yeah, which would be a sexy game.
Yeah.
But she ain't playing.
When the thing that has taken hold of Keiko causes her to stop breathing, I think that's when Miles knows it's not a game, because Keiko doesn't usually stop breathing that long when they're playing those other bedroom games.
Yeah, he's like, "But Keiko, you love Dan Savage. You know you're not supposed to engage in breath play."
So, right away, this is Rosalind Chow's episode, and she is hitting dingers from before the opening theme song.
It's true, man.
A dominant performance by her.
She does not get to be the center of attention that often on this show, but
yeah.
I think, like, maybe taking a page from the Marina Sirtis playbook, when she gets the chance, just demonstrates how criminally underused she is.
Yeah. There is, I think you could easily go ham and cheese when you go physical as an actor. And for whatever reason, she does not do that. Like, she flails around a bunch in this episode and does a lot of physical acting, but I think where she's best is working in between those two. Like, she's super venomous and expressive,
yeah,
in some very subtle ways. And the idea that she has been, I don't know if she's been intentionally sidelined or if she's gotten other jobs and is just a busy working actor, but like, she's not on the show very much, and it's just great to see her get an opportunity and really crush it.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing is that changing which character she's playing within a shot,
right,
thing, because like, she'll be this evil entity that's taken over her body and then be, as far as anyone not Miles can tell,
yeah,
just regular old Keiko. And she can flip that switch on a dime. Like, she's not like, I don't think Daniel Day-Lewis could do this, you know, like like you're never like, or you know, Sean Penn is not able to be two different things at once, because he needs to be the character he's playing the entire time and be a, yeah, dick to everyone that, like, you know, comes up to the craft services table alongside him.
I know that, dude.
Alan Croker's a first time director on the show with this episode, and I like how he was not inclined to go full haunted house with this. Like, they're not shooting her differently, they're not lighting her differently, they're not changing things that would tip you off about her. They're just allowing Rosalind Chow to act. And I think that shows a lot of trust, especially for a new director who I feel like would be inclined to come and splash around with these new characters.
This is a naked performance that has to stand up or the episode doesn't work.
And right.
Putting all of the weight of that on Rosalind Chow, it doesn't take bravery, but it takes confidence.
If you don't know the actors, it kind of does. You're just, yeah, trusting their reputation or what they're saying their abilities are.
Yeah. Anyways, she is explaining that she is she needs the chief to do some stuff technically to the station. And if he does it, he can have his wife back. If he doesn't, she dies. That's the stakes.
He's got to reconfigure the communication and sensor relays at the station. And Miles is like, I haven't seen either of those in years. Keiko changes in the bathroom.
Hey, actually, while you're here... Do you mind just disrobing to refamiliarize me with the layout?
You know, I might not ever get the chance if I get my old Keiko back.
She recoils to my touch, so if it's all the same to you, this could actually be great for me.
The Pa Wraith is like, you know, Keiko's in here and she just won't stop screaming.
You remember that time you like mentally went to prison for 30 years? She's kind of comparing it to that.
The timing for this body snatch couldn't be worse, because it's Miles O'Brien's birthday and there's a big party planned,
yeah,
for tonight. And so amidst all of this honey-do list that Miles has to do for Keiko around the station, there's also this social gathering happening later, and there's a big question about how this is going to go.
The reveal of this is in the scene when they first get home, and she drops the party info to Bashir, and then it, like, plays it off, like, oh, yeah, I meant to keep it as a surprise, but I blew it. And she's super cool to Bashir. And so, yeah, I guess this is like the morning, right? Because,
yeah, Keiko got the red eye, didn't she?
Yeah, she must have.
I think that explains sort of the empty docking ring too, right? Like, they're kind, yeah, of isolated for long periods of time.
God, I hate the red eye. I've flown the red eye so much this year.
That is against your contract.
I cannot stand it. And I have another couple red eyes already booked.
Oh, no. Don't know what to tell you, Ben.
Yeah. Sucks. But
gotta stop doing that.
Rom shows up. He's swinging to the swing shift.
Mm-hmm.
He's taking over for Duarte, who's out sick. And, you know, Rom is really, like, first day of schooling it. He, like, shows up with his lunch pail and is, like, really trying to make nice with all these engineers that he's going to be working with.
It's not like this on a night shift. We don't drink Ractogino.
You can tell he's a real fucking tryhard because he takes a swing shift the day after a midnight shift. And in some places, you're legally prevented from doing that because you're crossing over the eight-hour mark.
What is the Bajoran engineering union up to that they don't have their eye on the ball?
I don't like this at all. Rom got off work at midnight, and now he's coming back to work at like 3? That's
locked
shitty.
Up. Yeah.
It's not good.
Maybe Rom will unionize the workers on the station now.
That would be great.
He just keeps doing it?
Yeah. That's his thing.
Love that about him.
The birthday party that night provides a great setting to establish when nice becomes threatening.
Yeah.
Because all Keiko does is be nice. She's a great host. She made some great food, it looks like. Everyone's enjoying themselves. And O'Brien plays off of her in such an interesting and fun way because O'Brien is falling apart inside and he's moody and he doesn't like seeing the strange person in his wife's body interact with all of his friends and coworkers. And he's the one that looks out of place, not her.
There's some great direction in this. Like, there's kind of like a not super long, but longish oneer of him coming into the party and, like, you know, interacting with everybody. Like, Keiko isn't out yet, but she nails the timing of coming out with the birthday cake. And,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, I think what you get from Colm Meaney's performance is that he was hoping to come back to just her so that he could have a intense back and forth with her and say, like, I did what you asked. I changed all the communication relays or whatever. But instead, what he has to do is, like, be on and be bubbly and friendly and act like nothing's going on, because part of the deal here is that if he tells anyone else and whatever has taken over Keiko catches wind of it, that's her ass.
Yeah, there's a really fun scene where O'Brien is talking to the computer about the scan results of Keiko and is, like, running down a list of options to either knock her out or something. And every answer to every question is, like, it's not fast enough.
Yeah, he needs to get her unconscious in less than a hundredth of a second, according to her. So
Keiko has made it pretty clear that she am become dead man switch, right?
Yeah.
So, like, if at any point she detects her body is being fucked with, she will kill the container. Like, she's going to kill Keiko.
This novel I'm reading right now, like, a character comes aboard a spaceship and tells everybody that he has, like, a nuke in his head.
Uh-huh.
And that if they do anything to him, it will go off and, you know, blow up the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's one of those things where, like, they're forced to believe him because there's no way to determine one way or another if he's telling the truth.
Hey, Ben, does that guy have a mushroom haircut?
I don't know. What do you mean?
You know, like a mushroom cloud if he has a nuke in his head.
Oh.
I'm just playing around with words this episode, Ben.
I haven't been imagining him that way. But I thought you were referencing something specific. You were just referencing the shape of the explosion that happens when a nuke goes off.
Exactly.
O'Brien and Keiko do find a moment to sneak off by themselves when O'Brien smashes a whiskey glass in his bare hand.
This is after finishing the 6 fingers of whiskey that were inside.
That was an insane pour.
I've had some hard days, but I don't know if I've ever come home pouring 17 fingers of whiskey into a glass.
Poured yourself a Spanish beer glass full of whiskey and
neat too. Yeah, neat. Wow. Ugh, not refreshing.
this guy must have an incredibly high tolerance, because I would want to keep my wits about me if my wife's life was on the line.
Yeah, and you know what? On a birthday, the real stuff is getting busted out, so that's no synthahol.
No. She explains to him while she is using the butthole closer on his hand wound that the communication stuff that he was working on this time was just her way of making sure that he was willing to do what she was trying to get him to do. And the real modifications he's going to be making to the station start tomorrow.
Right. Yeah, he's killed a stranger to join the gang. Yeah. And now the real gangster shit's about to begin.
Yeah, he's jumped in.
Yeah.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pail.
A fucking pail.
Mr. Bucket,
I have to revert back to my living state. I don't use the bucket anymore.
We see the aftermath of this party, and she puts, I'm going to say, 66% of the cake into the replicator to be dematerialized and put back into the system.
But you don't see it floating out the window?
I think that is a perfect illustration of the problem with cake. It's too sweet. People don't really like it that much. People think they like cake, but too much cake is just too much.
I would argue that leftover cake is trash, and that's one of the things that makes pie superior. Leftover pie is often better than first day pie.
A pie that sat around for a day has only marinated.
Right.
Whereas, cake gets stale and shitty.
You get that bottom crust nice and gooey.
Yeah.
Comes out of the plate real nice. That's what you want. Pie for breakfast. It's what I want every morning.
Yeah.
Can't have it. It'd be bad. Incidentally, there are references to the paw wraiths and the fire caves in this episode, and Jake is the first one to ask about them.
Don't tell me you believe in wraiths.
It seems like just a kind of like an innocent question that isn't a plot point when he first brings it up.
Yeah, it's treated a little bit like a haunted house in kind of a jokey way. Like, oh, you're going to go to that old abandoned cabin? Watch out for the ghost of whoever it is. Like, there's no one who treats this seriously. The fire caves are real, but the paw wraiths are kind of a punchline at this point.
I never said I believe in them.
But they're kind of, they dangle there. As a thing that is referenced in a way that is a little bit ham-fisted, I think. I wonder if that is going to play into the solution to this or the explanation for this in any way.
Yeah, it's a very early snap into place by a couple of pieces.
Yeah. I mean, I don't hate it, but it leapt out at me.
Sometimes you like something like that a little later in the episode, too.
Yeah.
Oh, Brian has to be curious about what it's like to fuck a paw wraith, right? Like, it's got to be fucking bonkers.
His curiosity is almost satisfied, right?
Yeah, he's got to hop into bed with her and sleep like a normal wedded couple.
She insists that he sleep alongside her, I guess to maintain the illusion that she is who she claims she is.
Don't be too late. You've got a busy day tomorrow.
For Molly's sake, right?
For Molly, because, she doesn't want Molly dropping a dime on her.
I guess.
I would have loved a little bit more Keiko and Molly, like just Keiko and Molly scenes.
Right.
Or scenes where Keiko was with Molly. And we get the one where she's on FaceTime with Molly. But I would have loved a little bit more of O'Brien like seething that this imposter is touching his child stuff.
That FaceTime was pretty dark. That felt like a hostage video to me in all the right ways.
Yeah, no, it was great. And Molly was blinking in Morse code. That was cool.
Holding up that newspaper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Life video.
Yeah. The morning after, O'Brien gets his instructions. And once getting them, he's sort of free to roam. Like, he has tasks to do, but on the promenade, he incidentally, like, he asks where Odo and Captain Sisko are, and they're in the security office, and he makes up a reason to be on the promenade to go there. But like, as soon as he cops them across the hallway, Keiko calls to him from the railing, from the creep rail that Jake and Nog used to hang out at.
Yeah.
A rail that we've complained all the time about for safety reasons.
It's just not high enough. It's not to code.
Keiko proves our point by going ass over tea kettle and crashing to the floor.
This is not the first person we've seen go over this rail, though.
No.
I don't think.
No. Definitely not an OSHA-approved railing height there. But Keiko takes a bump, like takes it flat, the way you want to as a wrestler. Like,
yeah.
She displaces the force across her body. And it's why in the infirmary later, Bashir says it could have been so much worse. It's just it's a couple of bruises, a hairline fracture, and a gash.
Yeah, weird, right?
But there is the very awkward moment where Bashir's like, so you want to talk to her? You should really talk to her. She's your wife. Get on in there. And O'Brien's like, busy. And all Keiko wants to do is make out, which is the most awkward part.
Yeah. That scene where she insists that he kiss her before he leave and Bashir is like watching from the door is the creepiest scene in the episode and so well done.
It's great.
Because Colomini has to do all of the work of like expressing disgust and repulsion, but also it's his wife. But also his friend is watching, so he has to like make it look good.
He makes that little mouth.
Yeah.
The little kiss mouth.
Yeah. It's really
great.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah, but missed opportunity for O'Brien to confide in Odo and Captain Sisko, and Keiko knows it.
Yeah.
It's scary.
This was all to demonstrate how close she is to dying if he falls out of step.
I'm counting on you.
So O'Brien sort of wanders out of the infirmary into the promenade, and Worf finds him and asks about Keiko.
If there is anything I can do.
I wish there was.
O'Brien has to tell her that she's fine, but still sort of like spacey and shell-shocked. Worf has seen Keiko's gash before. He's seen it all.
Jesus.
So it's interesting that he's asking questions about her condition.
Are we canceled now? I would support canceling us at this point.
That was one of the rare pre-writes. And if you'll notice, if you were to back up this episode a good 30 seconds to a minute, I set it up.
Yeah.
Set it up in the deep background.
Wow.
That's professional work right there. I am a professional jokesman.
Dogpaw to temple.
So dumb. Cancel me. Don't cancel Ben. I am the Bashir in this moment. I killed the plant.
I'm cancelable, I'm sure.
Yeah. The point of this scene is that, like, O'Brien really wants to tell Worf what's happening because Worf seems like, as a past security man, he might be able to do something, but it's just another opportunity he can't take. It's too risky.
And then also the subtext is that, like, O'Brien has a ticking clock now, and any stop and chats are burning time he really desperately needs to get the station set up.
For him, all I need to do is just say hello.
You know, that was kind of rude.
That was not rude. I don't have to do a stop and chat with him.
She's given him 13 hours. And, and so, like, the next scene is him, like, trying to get started on this when none other than Rom sticks his head out of a Jeffries tube, and O'Brien kind of hits on something fairly brilliant. Like, Rom is the wrong guy in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
He is a perfect patsy because, like, the case that the Power Wraith has been making is that it knows everything that Keiko knows. And Keiko knows O'Brien down to his little subtle facial expressions that nobody else picks up on. This is like my wife can tell when I'm on Twitter just by like the facial expression I'm making when I'm looking at my phone.
Wow.
Because she can see me like trying to compose a joke, you know?
Oh, I
and
thought...
And it's written on my face.
I took that the other way. I took that as someone saying a bad thing. Yeah.
Oh, because somebody's being mean to me?
Yeah. If I look like I'm feeling bad about myself, that's why. I'm on Twitter.
Twitter.com, the soul-crushingest website.
Twitter.com, the depression machine. You're really right about Rom, though, and his utility here.
Because O'Brien doesn't really have a relationship with him. So
yeah.
But he's also a capable engineer. So like O'Brien can put Ron, and he's a little doofy. So O'Brien can kind of rope him into this scheme and get him going on it and give him a, this is a secret and Ron will believe it storyline.
I was disappointed that Rom didn't bring up breakfast to him. I thought this would be a perfect time to...
just work breakfast back into the conversation.
Yeah. So now that I'm on swing shift, what do you like to eat for lunch?
Yeah, predicted, it's not fun to do that impression.
Yeah, bad impression.
The impression police... want Adam.
Yeah, the impression police put me in the back of the cruiser not protecting my head.
Yeah. They let you ding yourself on the door jam there.
What are you doing now?
We get an exciting engineering montage, Ben, and I think there's a reason why we don't see these too often. It's just panels being pulled off of walls,
yeah,
and dildos being shoved into tight places.
Yeah, but I love that they licensed the "Working in a Coal Mine" song.
Yeah, really great. An increasingly bedraggled O'Brien ends up at ops at the end of his shift, and he's shocked to find Dax standing above him. This is a part of ops that typically explodes.
Yeah.
So we're set up to feel stress in the establishing shot, but it's weird that Dax is hovering over him because Dax should be asleep.
I want you to have a look at something.
She was supposed to be asleep and she was like up late going over anomalies because that's her like meditation is anomaly science. And she realized that something was amiss about the way the sensor array or something about the station was not working properly. And boy, Colomini's performance in the, like, she has him red-handed but doesn't realize it yet scene is fucking great.
Do you think if Dax was trying to pick out a movie to fall asleep to, she would have a stack of Jean-Pierre Jeunet films? And, you know, she'd consider picking up an Alien Resurrection, a delicatessen, or Anomaly.
Yeah, maybe City of Lost Children.
I have never had a worse show than this.
I'm doing better than I am, man.
I'm standing in a batting cage just like getting hit by softballs.
What are you talking about? You're doing better than I am. If you've never had a worse show than this, what does that say about me?
Ben, my question about Dax's insomnia is the ankylosaur inside her, is it possible for that to be on a different time zone than you? Like, are there times when it wants to be awake and you want to go to sleep and you're like... frustrated by it and it's frustrated by you?
It's like, can you turn off the lamp? I'm trying to sleep over here.
Yeah. It's like, I wonder how often you're kept up by it.
Sorry, I need it. I'm totally engrossed in this novel.
Yeah.
Fucking ankylosaur.
Ankylosaur.
That's got to be a pain in the ass.
I think my wife needs about two fewer hours of sleep per night than I do.
Really?
Like, she can just function, like... I don't know. Like, I sleep like 9 or 10 hours most nights. And
wow.
She's like, I think she could be perfectly happy with like 6.
That's tough.
Yeah.
That's tough. I need to get into a rhythm to feel like 6 is enough. Like the 6 hour outlier, I definitely feel. But if I rip off an entire week of 6 hours of sleep, like, I'm feeling fine by day 3.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's making me tired just thinking about it.
I need an adjustment period is what I'm saying.
Wow.
I don't want to get the sleep bends.
Yeah, I'm a total baby. I'm not sleepy all the time. I'm sleepy at bedtime.
Hmm.
But yeah, man. I get in bed at like 10 and set my alarm for 8:30.
That's a pretty good podcast life right there.
Yeah.
So, unanswered questions about Dax's insomnia, but she is there to share her her suspicions about there possibly being a saboteur on the station. She holds up a couple of sabots.
Hence the word sabotage.
In her hands, and says she found these. And in the wardroom, she brings them to the meeting.
I had a joke written about that, but...
Do yours.
No.
Maybe it's the one we keep.
No. My joke is worse, but it's also later.
Okay. Maybe so, drop that in later.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think I'm going to drop it in. I don't think it's as good.
I don't like that. I think you should leave it up to me as the editor. I'll take it out if it's bad.
Well, it's bad. I can listen. It's a joke I wrote 3 hours ago. I know it's bad. Take my word for it.
It's unclear whether or not Dax and O'Brien go to the wardroom from here and have a super early morning meeting, but there is a McLaughlin group in the wardroom.
Issue one.
I think the most confusing thing about this episode is what time things are happening at, because people keep making a big deal about what time things are or like how much time has transpired, except for we never feel anchored in any particular time.
Very true. Yeah. And it's in this meeting that... that thing happens where a couple of characters are describing a fourth person in the room exactly, and O'Brien is starting to freak out because they're describing the method of sabotage and who might be the person, like who the saboteur could be.
It has to be someone familiar with the station systems.
Someone with a lot of access. Maybe even someone on the maintenance crew.
Yeah.
And they're saying everything about O'Brien without saying anything at all.
Yeah, it's like a cop movie where the cop gets stuck investigating a murder that they committed or something.
It's some real Telltale Heart shit, because O'Brien is like really feeling the heartbeat of this moment.
Yeah, like the money shot of the scene is when he goes over to the window and the shot is like him in focus in the foreground and the three of them talking about who this could be in soft focus in the background.
Yeah. Why are you acting so weird, Miles?
Yeah.
Meeting's over here.
During this scene is when the FaceTime from Molly and Keiko comes in.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, like Keiko will miss no opportunity to remind Miles what is on the line here. So he winds up fingering the perfect fall guy also.
Right.
And there's a fucking hysterical shot of...
Rom Harvey Oswald is like watching a movie and gets pulled out of the crowd.
Yeah, just like laid out on the floor working in some you know, equipment bay.
Yeah.
With his butt crack is like the most prominent part of the shot. And then his head mimicking that butt crack right above it.
Yeah, it's a nice lobe. Symmetrical composition here.
And yeah, Odo takes Rom into custody as the saboteur.
It's great that it's Miles O'Brien involved in this whole thing because he has agency and technical prowess to get into and out of trouble. Because as soon as Rom gets thrown in the clink, your mind starts racing about like, what is he going to do and how is he going to communicate with him? How is he going to, you know, keep the cover up going? And so he immediately does that thing where he disables the security cams and microphones, and that frees him up to go visit him in the brig.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of wondered, like, does the computer have the ability to do all this work and he's doing it by himself for some reason? Because he does say, like, finish this calibration and then walks away from it.
It's funny, Pyraith Keiko gives O'Brien, like, the list of things on a pad, and O'Brien just, like, slumps onto the couch and is, like, hitting buttons and flicking things and like working from home.
Yeah.
The work from home episode of Deep Space Nine died in the writer's room.
Yeah.
What's great about this scene is that Rom is ahead of Miles O'Brien on the whole plan. Like, he gets it.
Is Rom smarter than Miles?
He's dumb like a fox.
Yeah, because he's figured out that it's all of these modifications have served to turn the station into a great big chronoton emitter pointed right at the wormhole.
We know of the value of chronotons from Star Trek First Contact when Commander Riker looked directly into the camera and said, time travel. right after they picked up...
Oh, you mean my close personal friend, Jonathan Frakes?
I do. I do mean the same. Yeah. Which is interesting. If you were going to use a weapon that would kill the wormhole aliens, and you know the wormhole aliens exist in a kind of unstuck from time situation, a chronotone particle is a very interesting weapon here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that would never harm a corporeal.
Right.
But it would...
Or the wormhole itself, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Do you think it would collapse the hole?
I don't think so. I think it would go into the hole and collapse what's inside. But crucially, the way Rom talks about this, he's like it would kill them before they knew it hit them.
Right, just over in a flash.
Which I think is like maybe a bit of a hand tip on the episode part.
Shit, you're right. Yeah, man, I wish that line of dialogue wasn't in it.
I mean, I think it has to be somewhere, right? Because you
can't just go A to C on...
They've spent so much time working on the amount of time that needs to be...
Yeah.
Like to get the possessor out of Keiko, it's 1/100th of a second, I think. And so before they knew what hit him is enough time, presumably.
Right.
But it does the episode is solved almost 10 minutes before it's actually over.
I feel like there might be a slider here where maybe taking some dialogue out of the first mention and adding it to the second, or some mix here might make it better than it is.
Yeah.
But it does clang a little bit here. It's just in a way that a lot of shows are like there's this delicate balance of not pandering too much to the lowest common denominator viewer who just is oblivious or watching on their phone or whatever.
Right.
Or watching while on their phone. That, yeah, it's a hard thing to do. So I get it. You get why shows do stuff like this.
Yeah, and I think that when you've written yourself a puzzle like this, it is basically impossible. Like, you need to have this information that before they would know it, they knew what hit him.
Right.
But I really like this scene. I love the ECUs that it's shot in.
I agree. Yeah. And they're doing little subtle pushes, aren't they?
Yeah. I think the camera work it seems very strong in this episode. A lot of really nice portrait shots of the characters. And, you know, for an episode where O'Brien and Keiko and Rom are all going through such major emotions, it's really nice to get as close as we get to see them kind of process that.
Right.
Morn. Morn.
Morn.
Dear sweet.
Morn.
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 Evening, everybody.
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
One thing I wanted to talk about in this scene is the placement of the commercial break. And I think it is super intentional and important to discuss, because before the commercial break, Rom has put everything together about the chronotone emitter and its effects on what the wormhole aliens would be.
Why are we trying to kill the wormhole aliens?
And then we get an O'Brienized commercial. And when we come out of the commercial, O'Brien and Rom are still talking. And it's a scene where Rom displays total understanding of Bajoran myth and Pa-wraiths.
What are you talking about?
And he puts the story together. And I think without the commercial break, Rom comes off as impossibly knowledgeable about every situation having to do with the episode. Unbelievably so. And so I really feel that was written intentionally for that reason. I think if you give Rom the entire run unbroken to not only solve for what O'Brien's doing, but also solve for Keiko, I think it's unbelievable.
That's a great point. I think that's really well written. And I guess, I don't know, I wonder, because the Chief does try and do the TNG thing of getting the computer to tell him the critical piece of mythology to understand what's going on earlier in the episode. And the computer spits back there are thousands of things written about Pa-wraiths. You know, it's I can't do this much homework in the time I have to solve this problem. And it's great that Rom is like has already done that homework just in hanging out with Lita, which is I think a big reveal, right? Like we haven't actually seen them get together.
Yeah, but
they have been They've been spending time together.
Do you think it's interesting or strange that, you know, for all of the information trading back and forth between O'Brien and Rom, O'Brien never discloses to Rom why he's made these changes, and Rom is never suspicious of him for them. Like, Rom doesn't know about the Keiko thing.
No, but he does put it together that a pod wraith couldn't go back to the temple without killing the prophets first.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting, like, invisible ink kind of moment in the story and the script. Like, because I think as a viewer, you are assuming a knowledge that Rom doesn't have.
Yeah, and this O'Brien says, like, she a couple of times in talking about, and Rom just doesn't pick up on it, does he?
Yeah, no. It's never explicit.
Wow.
Strange. But the episode is so tight and like it works super fast that like there's a moment where you consider it, but then you're just on to the next.
The like one of my favorite moments in the episode is when Rom says, like, if you need me to stay here and play the idiot, I know the role.
Yeah.
Like it really makes you think about like what's really going on with Rom.
Yeah. He does have some insight, doesn't he?
Yeah.
O'Brien goes straight back to work because he's on the timeline that we've talked about.
He's running out of time because, like, he's had to go distract himself. And he's back into the modifications he's making when he gets out. Odo didn't even need to disguise himself as a drink cart or anything.
Have you ever watched Scooby-Doo? There's a moment toward the end of every episode where there is a monologue about all the clues that led up to the moment where they take the mask off of the bad guy. And like, as soon as Odo gets to the end of that moment, O'Brien punches him in the face.
Yeah, O'Brien's like, little chin music here for you, Odo.
Yeah.
I'm out!
That's something he could have gotten away with earlier. He would have just, he would have been punching pudding at that point. This time he lands clean.
Yeah, I feel like the ability to knock someone out in one punch is something that is used in film and television occasionally. I don't know if it's true.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what you hope for. The longer a fight goes on, the worse and uglier it gets.
Yeah.
If only every fight ended that quickly.
Uppercut. You win.
But anyways, the modifications are complete, and O'Brien gets on the radio with Evil Keiko, and they agree to meet at a runabout. She's briefly like, "How did you know I needed a runabout?" And he acts like he put this together all himself. He like.
Keiko, like the real Keiko, comes through and she's like, "You're never this spontaneous ordinarily. Like, I've been wanting to go on vacation a lot and you never want to rent a runabout."
It's a bit like the way he left Bashir holding the bag earlier. He doesn't give Rom credit for putting this all together.
Yeah.
In this moment.
Yeah.
But they get on the runabout. He gets clearance. And then they head for the wormhole, and Evil Keiko starts to get real excited.
Oh, you have no idea how many centuries I've waited for this.
Let's get on with it.
This is like the bank heist that's actually happening, and O'Brien's the wheel man.
He starts punching in stuff, and we cut back to the station, and just like tons of lightning start emitting from it. And in ops, they are realizing something pretty messed up is about to happen. And
Worf is like, "This looks very familiar to me."
Well, move over, Worf Lightning, because Keiko Lightning is the new hotness.
Yeah.
That lightning hits the runabout, and Keiko lays waste to Michael Dorn's previous lightning performances.
True. You know she did her research.
Holy shit.
Yeah. She is totally spasmatic.
Amazing. Yeah. The beam has been aimed not at the wormhole, but at the runabout. And before the Power Wraith knew what hit it, it dead.
You really want to do this? Here. Now. Okay. Let's do it.
We cut back to Casa O'Brien in the aftermath. Like, she hits the ground, and then we're back in the casa.
Yeah.
And Keiko seems better now than she was in the infirmary after falling off the railing, even though she's been hit with gigawatts of wharf lightning.
Yeah.
She's fine.
Right before that, we get the scene of them coming off of the landing pad and, like, Odo, like, working his jaw and Sisko saying, you've got some splaining to do.
Right.
But it is pretty clear that everything is forgiven.
Right.
All the way down to bonsai trees, like... O'Brien gets to be the hero somehow.
Yeah. Pretty messed up. Pretty messed up that Keiko never apologizes either. It's just not fair. Just a real double standard there, Ben.
Yeah. She talks about what it was like to have a Power Wraith in her head, and it was like coiled up around her mind.
Yeah. Miles never got that deep.
Jesus.
You gotta be a real stick man to reach the mind.
Loki, a great character moment for him, is saying, like, you don't have to tell me about that if you don't want to. And her saying, like, no, I want to talk about it and unpack it. Like,
it's like, weird that O'Brien could also find common cause here and be like, my mind was also briefly taken over and you were there. Remember? They have a lot in common now after this ep.
It's true.
The button on the episode is in Quarks. We get Quarks bookends here because Rom has been promoted to the day shift. He's really been bouncing around. I think his sleep life is totally fucked up at this point.
Yeah, he's super tired, not because he was working all night or in jail or anything, but because he was out celebrating. And a bit undercutting the stuff about Lita earlier, he says, like, one of the ladies on the day shift likes hanging out with him.
Well, maybe they have an open relationship.
Maybe. Rom is really a player.
Was Rom promoted to day shift because of his willingness to conspire with O'Brien? Like, is that part of it? He's willing to do bad things. And then he gets a promotion.
Yeah.
That's weird.
That is weird.
But I guess it's just a shift promotion, right? Like, it's not a rank promotion. It's just like,
right. Sometimes
when you've got seniority, you can have a better schedule.
These guys are mostly, like, plunging out clogged toilets. It's not like... that often that, like, highly sensitive missions get down to the engineering staff of the station.
Do you think Worf's toilet has two holes in the bottom?
Anything fewer would be without honor.
Yeah. You really gotta give Worf's toilet the golf ball test, don't you? That's what you call a plumber's lament. You get Worf sitting on that thing.
That is the classic plumber's lament.
Don't know if I agree with Rom's breakfast order here at the end, though. It really sounds like something you'd get at a Westin Maui.
That's what you ordered at the Hash House of Go-Go in Vegas.
I got...
great big pancake?
I got bananas pancake. It was delicious.
Yeah, that's a good banana pancake at that place.
It's the size of a manhole cover, though.
It's huge.
You know when your pancake creeps over the sides of your diner plate, that's... a lot of pancake.
Yeah, it's a lot of pancake.
A lot of episode to discuss, Ben. Did you like it?
I did like it. I thought it was a lot of fun, a fun adventure. Great Rosalind Chow episode, great Colm Meaney episode, great Max Grodanchik.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Hey, you gave it a try.
Yeah. It's possible that some sebo have been thrown into my pronunciation.
Yeah, I could see that. That's what I'm hearing.
Did you like the episode, Adam?
A lot. A lot, a lot. But I only liked it up to a point, Ben. The absence of Nana Visitor did put a ceiling on my enjoyment of the ep, so I will give it that caveat.
Yeah.
As good as an ep can be without Anna.
Your girl is palling around with Shikar on Bajor.
our girl shooting babies. She was out giving birth when this episode was shot and made.
Yeah.
So there it is.
Good for her. Congratulations, Nana.
Congratulations indeed.
It's a belated congratulations.
Yeah, like 20 years late. One thing that is also 20 years late most of the time are the readings of our Priority One messages. You want to see what we got, Ben?
Would love to.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental. Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Ben, our first Priority One message is of a commercial nature.
Yeah!
The message goes like this.
That's twice as much money for us. Woo! Because companies are less cost sensitive than humans.
Yeah, that's the thinking behind business class seats on airplanes.
Yeah. Companies are not people.
Love's Lust Lost is a comedy adventure novel about Captain Dick KK. That could be Kake. K-A-H-K-A-Y. Kake. I'm going to say Captain Dick Kake as he rises through the ranks and betrays the only woman he truly cares about.
Whoa.
It's a universe journey novel spun off from a It's All Been Done radio hour. Buy it now on Amazon. And then we're given a URL. You can go to https://tinyurls.com/loveslustlost.
Wow.
I'm clicking the link right now. There it is. You can get this bad boy in paperback on the Kindle, both of which very reasonably priced.
Cool.
Oh, and we got some ratings on here. We've got 3 5-star ratings for
right.
Love's Lust Lost, and it's written by Jerome Wetzel. Jerome Wetzel is the author.
Great.
So check it out.
Yeah, this sounds like a fun read, huh?
It's All Been Done Presents is a multi-platform entertainment company based in Columbus, Ohio that produces podcasts, written work, video, and more.
Wow.
So that's the story.
What fun.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great project, and hope the friends of DeSoto support them. Adam, we have a second Priority One message here, and it's from Rob, and it's for Ben.
Oh, no.
It says, you picked my 35th birthday to call me an arsehole in front of my friends for not supporting Greatest Gen financially. As you can see, it worked. Thank you for recruiting me to the Friends of DeSoto and for reminding me of my first duty. You truly are a man of special conscience and among the most human souls I have encountered in my travels. Wow. Well, Rob, I'm sorry to have called you an asshole or an arsehole. I don't know if I've ever called anyone an arsehole.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
That doesn't sound like me, but either way, I apologize. But thank you for supporting us. I'm glad it worked, and happy 35th birthday.
Rob, I take great umbrage in your description of Ben as a man of special conscience. A descriptor saved specifically for me,
well,
Kevin Uxbridge.
Kevin, you obviously have a special conscience. I would say you have the specialist conscience, but other people can have somewhat special consciences, you know? It's a continuum, like the Q.
Benjamin R. Harrison is a good man, but I don't think he's got the stones for genocide.
I certainly don't. I admit it, Kevin. I have no willingness to fit that crime.
Ben doesn't have the stones for genocide, but you, the viewer, may have the money to purchase a Priority One message, and both styles go a long way to supporting the ongoing production of the show. The personal message is $100, and the commercial messages are $200. They're great for birthdays and books, as this episode is a great example.
Thanks for supporting the show.
Gotta get that gold press latch. Get that
gold press latch.
Am I right? Yeah. Am I right?
Mother's Day is coming up, and one of the best gifts you can give a mom that you might share a bed with is doing some yard work downstairs, if you know what I mean.
with Manscaped. This season, make sure you groom your carpets and your drapes with the leaders in below-the-waist grooming. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVS at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants to let the mother of your children know how much you appreciate her continuing to put up with you.
Moms, can't live with them, can't find a great gift for them. It's madness, and it's the same every year. Mother's Day comes around, and it's like, what's it going to be this year? Another robe? Another candle? Slippers? A sweater? Flowers? We've got to do better than that, right? Well, you can, and it's actually the best gift you could possibly give a loved one. An Aura frame. Now, we have a policy to only do ads on our show for things that we actually like and use, and I gotta tell you, the Aura frame is probably the best gift I've ever given. The folks I've given an Aura frame to love it, and I love it too, because when you give an Aura frame, you're not just giving a person a bunch of old pictures, you're giving them new pictures every time you send one to it. Right now, Aura has a great sale for Mother's Day. Viewers can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com, and the code is SCARVS at checkout to show your support for the show. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Drunk Shimoda!
I mean, one of the most pure expressions of Shimoda is like the actor having the best time. I don't feel like anyone's having a better time than Rosalind Chow here.
Like, yeah.
She is really exploring the space of the entire episode, and she fucking crushes it. Like, there's the Shimoda that makes fun of the recipient, and that is definitely not what I'm doing here. Like, I think she is having the most fun. For me, it's got to be her. What about you?
Rom got the shits from Bacon.
Right. Yeah.
So
That's a good one, too.
That's my drunk Shimoda.
Is the next episode going to give us the shits, Ben? Only you can tell us. What's it going to be about?
Next episode is Season 5, Episode 6, Trials and Tribulations.
Wow.
Big episode. Sisko travels back in time to a pivotal moment in the history of the original Starship Entrepreneur.
What we're going to do for this episode is we're going to drop this episode on our regular Monday.
Then the next Greatest Discovery episode that comes out will be about the original The Trouble with Tribbles episode.
So it'll be a very
triple tribute.
There you go. God. That was great. Really glad you're here for that.
I don't know if it was great. I think it was medium okay.
Our tribute to the Tribbles.
It's Tribble Timber.
Yeah, all right. Well, we better find out how we're going to watch that up, Ben.
Yeah, we better do that.
Oh, only I can tell us.
let's head over to gach.biz/game, where we keep the game of buttholes, Will of the Prophets.
Wouldn't it be great if this were a Quarks Bar episode? We are right on the doorstep of one. We're on square 17, just tickling the ear of Quark's head.
And you almost always roll ones, Adam, so the chances are not bad.
I know.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
All right, here we go. I have rolled a 6, Ben.
Chula!
Did I win?
Hardly.
Fuck.
A six really blows that Quark's Bar episode away into the deep background and puts us on the doorstep of a banger.
Fuck.
So there we are, a regular ep that I intend to celebrate with a couple of beverages personally. I think it's only right that a silly episode gets a silly drink. So maybe we'll do something like that.
We should come up with a triple cocktail, something with a little fur in it.
That is disgusting. you gonna grab some pubes and drop them in your cocktail as garnish? It's fucking gross.
Does sound kind of gross.
Can't wait to watch it, Ben. This is one I've heard about quite a bit over the years, and I've never seen it myself.
Oh, it's a really cool episode.
Yeah.
They had a lot of fun with it. Looking forward to... In the meantime, folks who like the show can head to MaximumFun.org/donate to support it. You'll get access to all of our bonus content. There's tons and tons of bonus content on there.
It's true.
You should also listen to The Greatest Discovery, our other Star Trek podcast. We got two.
It's a Star Trek about all the new Star Trek, and there is so much new.
There's a lot going on over there, and, it is currently in the, like, every other week off-season mode, but I can't imagine that's going to last much longer.
It is a fun, like, creative sandbox for us.
Yeah.
Having to do with Star Trek. It's good. I'm glad we have it.
So, give
you're
it a
You're missing
listen.
Out if you're not listening to that show.
We gotta thank Adam Ragusea, who makes all the music for this program, and Dark Materia, who made the original Picard song upon which the Sisko song is based. We gotta thank Bill Tilly, who makes trading cards every week, posting those on Twitter using the hashtag GreatestGen.
Seek out The Greatest Generation on social media. You know where and how to do that. And with that... we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. That's doing that thing where you're like, feels like you got a hair in your mouth and you're like pinching your tongue, trying to get it off. Trying to get that hair out of your mouth. So you're like, it's very, very distracting.
Yeah, no kidding.
Do not like that feeling.
I think I swallowed a few big hair.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.